Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this Courthouse Steps webinar following today's oral arguments in Chevron USA Incorporated v. Plaquemine Parish, Louisiana. My name is Libby Dickinson, and I'm an assistant director with the Federal Society's Practice Groups and Networks. As a reminder, all opinions expressed are those of our speaker and not of the Federalist Society. To that point, today we're honored to be joined by Carrie Campbell-Severino, president of the Judicial Crisis Network and co-author with Molly Hemingway of their best-selling book, Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Court. She was a law clerk to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and to Judge David B. Sentell of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, and is a graduate of Harvard Law School, Duke University, and Michigan State University. If you have any questions throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them through Zoom's Q&A feature, not the chat, located at the bottom of your screens so that we'll be able to access them later. With that note, I will hand things over to Carrie. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be here. So just to start out with a summary of the case, this is one of those cases that deals with a really important issue, but procedurally, it's a little bit complicated. So bear with me. I'll try to make this as clear as possible. So the case is Chevron versus, I believe it's pronounced Plaquemine Parish, and this is a parish in Louisiana. They're suing under a Louisiana law passed in 1978. It's the Plaquemine Parish and the state of Louisiana and some other related parishes are suing Chevron, as well as a bunch of other oil and gas companies, under a law, their State and Local Coastal Resources Management Act of 1978. And this law was passed in 1978, went into effect in 1980, and basically regulates the way that oil and gas drilling is done and which types of things you need permits for. They're claiming that Chevron and in related cases, a lot of other organizations have violated these permit requirements. But significantly, they're claiming they did so in actions going all the way back to World War II. Now, that's unusual because obviously this law wasn't passed until the 70s, didn't come into effect until 1980. And in fact, the law has an explicit grandfather clause in it. So it says you don't need to have coastal use permits for an individual specific use legally commenced or established prior to the effective date of the coastal use permit program. So prior to 1980. Obviously, World War II in the 1940s, way prior to 1980. So one would assume that period of time before 1980 would not have been something that any actions taken then would not have been subject to these requirements. Louisiana and Plaquemine Parish are claiming otherwise, and they're claiming that they are owed damages based on lots of different allegations. They've dredged canals going through wetlands. They have drilled wells without restoring them properly. They've dumped wastewater from their production into the marshlands, all of these different things. Litigation went to trial. They originally sought $2.6 billion in damages. They went to trial and ultimately were awarded a mere $745 million in damages. Nonetheless, a very significant lawsuit. And Chevron is attempting to remove these arguments to the federal court. So it's not, today's not a question, isn't really about are they liable for this? And in fact, it's not even exactly about should the grandfather clause cover this, which is going to be a key issue in the case. Is their action covered by this grandfather clause or not? The real issue is who decides? Who decides the answer to those questions? Is this something that should have been decided in state court, or is this something that should be decided in federal court? And Chevron's argument is that it should be decided in federal court because there is a federal officer removal statute that provides for cases arising under actions that have to do with the federal government. And I can read you the language that have to be taken to federal court. So if it's that says if there's a civil action or a criminal prosecution against any person acting under an officer of the United States for or relating to any act under color of such office, you can remove that to federal court. And there's a good reason for this. It came up in our arguments today because from the beginning of the country, we've recognized that state and federal governments often have different interests, and they often can be somewhat at odds with each other. In fact, that's part of the genius of our Constitution, is we believe these checks and balances and these competing powers are going to help protect liberty ultimately for the American people. But the federal government recognized that there could be situations where there might be incentives for a state or local court system not to be friendly to federal law. And some examples that that came up during argument today of times when this was an issue were things like the War of 1812, where Northeast states were not happy about this war, and so they might not be inclined to want to go along with questions of that dealt with it. But nonetheless, this was the federal law, and the federal government had to be able to have its claims heard in a fair and impartial manner. Similarly, during Reconstruction, a lot of the southern states not so happy about the way the federal government was running things. Nonetheless, you want to make sure the federal law is being equally applied both in Alabama and in Massachusetts. And so they're going to have the opportunity for certain types of activity to be held in federal court. It doesn't mean they get out of any related state law claims, but if they have a colorable federal defense, then those under federal law, those claims then need to be heard in federal court. So that's what's at question today, is should Chevron have its case be able to be removed and heard before federal court? Again, that doesn't answer the final question of whether or not they're going to be liable for this. Maybe the federal court still finds them liable, but they're saying we know at least we're going to get more of a fair shake if we are getting this heard in federal court. So some of the issues that came up during oral arguments today, just to preview a little by where I think the outcome is going. I think it's obviously never a guarantee just based on oral arguments alone. But I do think we probably could count to five in terms of the number of votes in this case. And, one other procedural thing, actually, before I go into the arguments raised, it is significant that counting to five is just one notch harder in this case than it normally is, because Justice Alito recently, like just a couple days ago, had announced that he was going to be recusing in this case. He, among the justices, seems to have this come up a little more often than not. Than others, simply because of some different stock holdings he has. But an organization for which he holds stock is, even though they're not part of the case currently, is part of one of the underlying cases. And so once that was brought to his attention, he said, okay, in that case, I do need to recuse in this case. So there were only eight justices, and that means Justice Alito's vote is not one of those five that Chevron would need to prevail, or that the Plaquemine County would need to prevail. I think at the end of the day, it looked to me like there probably are those five votes, with some caveats of, I think the court's going to have to be careful how it writes the opinion to make sure that this doesn't become a wide open open door for almost any activity to go to the federal courts. And that brings me to, I think, the main question that the court grappled with today, which is, what are the limits on, and this is always a challenge for the court to deal with. If we adopt your side, how is it limited? And I think there were concerns brought up, particularly by the Chief Justice and Justice Gorsuch, who talked about the butterfly effect. How far can we go in saying actions are related to a government contract? So some things that got brought up were, say, a state labor laws. Is that going to, requiring a minimum wage for workers that would be working on this federal contract, among others? Is any case for violation of those labor laws, is that now being brought into federal court potentially? If the state regulates some early precursor to some material required for a contract, does that now somehow bring us into the realm of something that's going to be removable? And the answer that Paul Clement, who was arguing for Chevron, tended to give was, you know, this attenuation is going to be a real question here. This is going to be a challenge for the court to figure out. They're going to have to discern how to draw those lines, but they don't necessarily have to make that decision in this case. That's something that also the Solicitor General's office, which also had argument time in on Chevron's side in this case, that was something they also mentioned. They said if there's a problem with this law, that it's too broad, yeah, we're going to have some line drawing problems. First of all, the line drawing problems aren't really significant in this particular case. And second of all, to the extent that there are line drawing problems, it's really the fault of Congress. Congress's language here is admittedly very broad, and the Supreme Court has previously described how broad it is, and so and said that it was intended to be broad. So they're going to be trying to find a way to say there's a certain level of attenuation. When the Chief Justice went back and forth about with the Solicitor General's office on this, ultimately they said, well, you could just say we're not going to decide this question today and we'll just go as far as this. And the chief said, well, okay, how many times do we say that? We've said that before in other cases. It's going to drive the lower courts crazy if we keep on saying that. So I think the court is cognizant of that, where are the limits question. That said, I do think there's room for the justices to address that concern if they rule in favor of Chevron. I think Justice Kagan may have sensed that potential opening that the Chief Justice from the get-go in the argument laid out of how do we limit a potential decision in favor of Chevron. And she was making arguments basically saying that limiting the reach of this removal statute simply by saying it only applies when you have a colorable federal defense. So, you know, that's the Chevron and the Solicitor General's office said that's a really strong limitation. That's going to do a lot of work because you can't remove it for just anything. It has to be a colorable federal law-based defense. Justice Kagan, on the other hand, characterized that as just barely above frivolous. So she was clearly trying to push back on that and maybe potentially appeal to Chief Justice Roberts's concern about making sure the law was limited. And again, Justice Gorsuch using language like the butterfly effect, how far is a but-for cause, like if this is a really distant relationship to the government's interest in this case. Now, in this case, the facts underlying the government's interest here are they were being required to produce aviation gasoline, which was necessary for the war effort, at levels that far surpassed the typical extraction rates or is the typical production rates. And that a key factor in making that gas was the crude oil that they were mining in Louisiana, including in Plaquemine Parish. So this connection between the government's requirement, which is the aviation gas, and the crude oil is one of the areas that this case gets tricky with. So it's the fact that the contract doesn't state that you have to drill crude oil at a certain pace. They simply presume that they're going to be having the crude oil because they're vertically integrated as an industry to produce the aviation gas. So, there's going to be questions as how close a connection is there to the actions to mine this crude oil in with the aviation gasoline. But again, I think this is going. There's at a minimum, is there a colorable federal defense there that they were doing this in favor of because of it was necessary for the government contracts is the real question. And perhaps the details of, okay, now it's colorable. Now we can determine whether that nexus is close enough might be something that would be left to whichever court ends up with this, the state court or the federal court. Another question that came up several times during oral argument revolves around the 2011 amendments to that federal removal statute, which is really what creates the key language at issue here, having to do with the for or relating to any act under color of such office. So that language was added in 2011 to the federal removal statute. So now it's not just removal for lawsuits based on acts under color of the federal office, but for or relating to any act under color of such office. Clearly, this language is very broad. Clearly, it was intended to broaden it. And the context is there was a congresswoman who's being sued and under subpoena in state court. And Congress wanted to make sure that type of action, which seemed like maybe what we might now consider a classic lawfare type activity, was removable to federal court to make sure that members of Congress in that case, but also other federal actors, were going to get a fair shake. That's why the or relating to language was asked. And so this is where the government and Chevron saying, OK, look, yes, it's broad, but this language was intended to be broad. It was intended to broaden the statutory the type of actions covered by the statute. Now, the flip side of this was a question that was most prominently brought up by Justice Jackson, which said this amendment was made in the context of a conforming amendment. And this is supposed to be just trying to reconcile different aspects of the bill. It wasn't really, from her description, trying to make a dramatic change in the standard. It's a general rule. And in some cases, the court has commented that we don't assume that conforming amendments are going to have a major impact on the breadth of a statute. And she pointed also to congressional testimony, which obviously not all the justices are going to be interested in looking at. Not everyone thinks legislative history is particularly worth their while, but that is a question that that came up several times. Justice Gorsuch pointed out during Plaquemine Parish's arguments that he didn't see them particularly relying heavily on the conforming amendment language. So he basically was suggesting, all right, maybe this is something that's a bee in Justice Jackson's bonnet, but I don't see that this is something that even the advocates for Plaquemine Parish are really trying to hang their hat on. That's a pretty weak argument all told. And in Paul Clement's answer to her was chiefly, look, there are some statutes that talk about how conforming amendments aren't supposed to make major changes, but at the end of the day, the most important thing is we have to look at what the text itself says. So most of the time you get that kind of language as dicta after they've already said the language doesn't make a big change. And besides, we wouldn't expect it to because it's a conforming amendment. So that's that was another major area that the court was looking at. There were some questions that were brought up by Justice Barrett regarding a difference of opinion on the parties, whether this underlying group, PAW, which was, I believe, the Petroleum Activities During Wartime Petroleum Administration for War, which is the federal agency that is relevant to this case, that was establishing all of the underlying regulations, whether that was actually a federal entity. It seems that the parties may have agreed on this, although Plaquemine Parish didn't really want to agree totally. I think they want to preserve that as something that they could later challenge and say this wasn't even properly a federal agency. But certainly Chevron says they think it's pretty settled law that it is, and they felt like the depth of regulation going on during this time in terms about everything down to apparently the angle of some of the drilling being done was regulated by that PAW agency. So the unusual depth of government interest and regulation there did play into the arguments. Now, simply making an argument that something is under color of federal law alone, simply because of the regulation, that's something that the court also discussed a little bit. There's an underlying case called Watson, and the Watson versus Philip Morris. And this case was brought up, I think, initially maybe by Justice Thomas. It was brought up several different times that clarifies that just because an industry is heavily regulated, that alone is not enough to trigger the federal removal statute. And so that case is in the background there. But I think it's significant that Chevron isn't simply arguing that it's about the heavy level of regulation that PAW is doing. It's also saying, look, there are these government contracts, and in order to fulfill these government contracts, we were required to drill in this manner, on top of the fact that they were regulating it in a serious and involved way. Ultimately, I think the standard that Chevron really produced that seems like the court was probably very open to was the action that could trigger a claim that would be subject to federal removal is the question to determine if that action is subject to federal removal is, would enjoining that action have an effect on the government's ability to get to achieve its goals, to achieve what it was doing in that particular contract. And what they said is, absolutely, if they were subject to these added state regulations in that case, that would have undermined the government's ability to get supplied with the aviation gasoline that they required. There was a little bit of a debate, because the first time Clement articulated that standard and suggested it, he used the word direct and said, would enjoining this action have a direct effect on the government's ability to get this thing done? So there were some back and forth between him and just different justices, and also then with the Plaquemine Parish Council over, okay, wait, do you really mean direct? I think it was Justice Kavanaugh who brought that up. Justice Kavanaugh brought up in several cases trying to make sure that he understood fully the extent of federal authority and federal interest in the case. And one of those questions is direct really part, should that really be part of the test? Not surprisingly, Paul Clement said, actually, no, I apologize. That language, you know, it would be a great, that's a fine place to start, but we really think direct should not be part of there ultimately. Of those federal interests that Justice Kavanaugh brought up, he also wanted to know why it is that Chevron and the federal government felt that there is a problem with having these cases heard in state courts. And they talked about both the general issues that I alluded to earlier of having a state court that has a mixed set of incentives in a case like that, where you're a court locally that realizes this, a win in this case would be a very large benefit to your local community. Are you really going to be able to get a fair shake in a court under those circumstances? And he also asked, okay, there's that general concern. Are there any specific concerns? And that's where Paul Clement alluded to the fact that there actually already has been a verdict in a trial in the state court and the state court said, you know, the grandfather clause does not apply. Whereas a similar case that ended up being tried in the federal courts said the grandfather clause is basically conclusive in this case, and you don't even get past step one to be bringing this case. So it shows you the major contrast that you have here between the way a state court in this actual issue has already treated it versus the federal court, which gave a lot more credence to some of the arguments being made by the federal contractors in this case. And they also talked about the challenge of workability, of being required to explicitly mention in every statute if you have a term that you want to make sure that you can't be sued in state court over. Because this is one of the arguments that got brought up at the Fifth Circuit of, well, you know, it's only actually acting under color of federal law. If the contract really provided you have to drill in XYZ way, well, now that type of suing about those details can be removed to federal court. The argument from the government and from Chevron is this would be very unworkable if every single federal contract had to go into excruciating detail and brainstorm every possible aspect under which their contractee could then potentially be sued. So, at the end of the day, I want to make sure I leave some time for your questions. But at the end of the day, really, I saw three pretty clear votes for Plaquemine Parish in the state of Louisiana. Not terribly surprisingly, it was Justice Jackson, Justice Kagan, and Justice Sotomayor. I guess I didn't mention Justice Sotomayor's comment, but she basically was talking about how this might be a too broad of a standard to allow this many types of actions to be removed to federal court. I think those three really telegraphed that they were pretty seriously considering voting for Plaquemine Parish. I thought ultimately Justice Thomas's questions about line drawing and made me maybe think that he was going to be sympathetic to Chevron. Similarly with Justice Kavanaugh's questions, where he was concerned about the downsides for the federal government and their ability to work with their contractors when there's this type of potential liability dangling out there in courts that aren't necessarily viewed as fair and even-handed. I think Justice Barrett struck me as favorable to Chevron. She particularly was questioning the parish's council about whether they were willing to, or Louisiana's council about whether they were going to be bound by some concessions in the lower court arguments. And the fact that she viewed that as a problem for them, I think, suggests to me she's probably leaning toward just the Chevron's argument. Also, Justices Gorsuch and the Chief Justice, I think, were maybe a little bit less clear. Justice Gorsuch, I think, did seem like when he was talking about the conforming amendments, that he definitely thought that the that Plaquemine Parish's arguments weren't maybe as strong. The Chief Justice was concerned about limits and attenuation, but I thought those questions were answered fairly effectively. So it really comes down to maybe whether he agrees and thinks that the court will be able to cabin in and not say, you know, any government contractor could be removed to federal court for almost any open-ended question, but really that the court would be able to write this in a way that means that it truly has to be connected to, but as the statute says, related to is still a broad language, and at least as long as it's related to the federal activity that's at issue here. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions from the audience, and otherwise we'll have to just wait for the end of the term to find out the ultimate answer, and we'll see if my guess is correct.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Carrie. That was a great summary and breakdown of what were some really complex and fascinating arguments this morning. Looking at our questions, we have one question asking about Justice Kavanaugh's seven county opinion and how that informs the court standards on proximity, time and place.
Justice Kavanaugh's seven count. I'm not sure I'm up on that one. So,
okay. Well, let me hand that. You brought your receipts. then our other question was that we have so far, but please, to our audience, please feel free to submit your questions. Make sure that they do pertain to the case. They are, you know, to quote from this morning, they're related to the case. But yeah, no, that's an interesting question on proximity. Carrie, were you reading, you know, in your research on this case, was there anything that really surprised, that stuck out to you that you didn't quite expect in today's arguments?
Let's see. I mean, not terribly. I think I was looking at my notes here. I felt like, to be honest, one of the things that was refreshing is that it didn't take potentially 3 hours. It's a little nerve-wracking when they've got multiple people arguing on one side that it could take even longer than it did. So, you know, I think it clocked in as only an hour and a half. That's not too bad at the end of the day. I guess I would have loved to see a little clearer tipping of people's hands on a few of these votes, because it's not, you know, I don't think it was really cut and dry how many of the justices were going to vote, except perhaps for the liberal justices were very clear. But I still, nonetheless, I felt very encouraged by seeing, as someone who thinks that Chevron does have the better of this argument, by seeing where the direction the justices were going. I actually thought, you know, nowadays Justice Thomas asks a whole lot more questions than he ever used to. When I was clerking for him, he hadn't asked a question in about 10 years. And he asked quite a few questions today, more than he does in some cases even. So that was interesting to see him engaging so deeply on that, on the question.
I can't claim to know Justice Thomas anywhere near as well, but I did notice that as well. He does have a reputation, you know, for staying more quiet. But all right, we have another question. Do you think that there's more of a likelihood of staying in state court where suits are brought under delegated programs such as the Clean Air Act or Safe Water Drinking Act, where the states affirmatively receive delegation of authority from the federal government?
Well, I think the fundamental question here isn't how much of the federal government is delegating its authority to the state. I mean, certainly it's not a question really of whether the state law is the correct law to apply here. Everyone agrees they're going to be applying this Louisiana law, and they're going, whether it's state court or federal court. It's really just, is this related enough to the federal contracts at issue here for the federal removal statute to apply? So that is the underlying question. And certainly you can imagine scenarios in which in a Clean Air Act, a Clean Water Act, all of these cases where you've got federal the delegated state laws coming out of those cases, where you've got a contract that is connected and relating to very closely with what the federal government is, what the entity is doing for the federal government. And so the fact that that the state government can have some regulatory power there doesn't really answer the question, doesn't go to the full question of the federal removal statute.
Great. And then we have, you know, the ever anxious question of, you know, when we'll expect the decision to be handed down, but that probably won't be till June.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole lot of cases that'll probably be left till June, and this very easily could be one of them, particularly because, you know, we're not getting it until the second semester, as it were, of the term. No one really knows, you know, how fast they'll write these things, but this one seems like it's a complicated enough case that it seems to me it's not going to be one that's going to just write itself overnight. There's going to be a lot of details to have to iron out and get clear in the case. On top of which, since it looks to me like it's probably going to be a relatively close argument, that will, often mitigates against them coming out quickly on a decision. Just as a side note, because it is an 8-judge court, that means there's the potential that it could even go 4-4. Now, as we saw recently in the Oklahoma case, I guess just last term was that, the outcome in that case would be that the underlying decision just stands, but it doesn't have a Supreme Court precedential level of approval of that lower court decision. It's just as if the court had really never taken cert in the first place. And that means that Plaquemine County would prevail in this case because Chevron was the petitioner.
Fascinating potential there. One that, you know, be interesting to see when it comes down. All right, we'll leave it one last chance for anybody to submit an audience question. We will see if it ends up this, the 4-4 decision might be an interesting way to decide, as you said, for Plaquemine Parish.
Yeah, I hope not. I
think throwing in the curveball at the last minute.
This is why it's good to have 9 justices. And, exactly. And this is why it's a good thing not to have overly broad recusal laws. Now, I think Justice Alito, if he has a financial stake, even in the lower levels of this case, absolutely was correct for him to recuse himself in this case. But I think it's a reminder of when we have people who seem to be trying to push recusal at the slightest whiff of anyone, you know, raising a question of, well, don't you have friends who care about this case? Or don't you, you know, don't we think this justice has an opinion about the case? Well, of course they all have opinions, and and it's hard to imagine a justice who doesn't know someone within the federal government or something that has an interest in a case. That's never been the standard. It's never been the standard that if one of your law clerks isn't, former law clerks is involved in the case in some way, that you have to recuse yourself. there's a lot of things that people have kind of floated as reasons to recuse that would be inappropriate. And this type of risk is exactly why everyone from, you know, Justice Breyer on spoke really clearly about this, but onto the current justice of the court has said it's one thing at a appeals court level to recuse yourself, you know, as a default or as a, you know, have that be the tiebreaker in favor of recusal at the appeals court level, because there's always other judges who are waiting in the wings who can just join that three-judge panel that you were on. The Supreme Court, it's a fixed nine-justice panel, and it's very easy for people to predict, you know what, if I could get this particular justice off, that might increase my odds. And so I think it opens the door to strategic attempts at recusal, and for the court to go through a whole lot of trouble, the litigants to go through a whole lot of trouble to try to resolve a case that ultimately then is just a waste of everyone's time and resources.
All right, we have two last questions. One attendee asks if you could explain your reasoning on why the state court's interests related to the local community had a bearing on its decision in one of the cases that you mentioned, other than the argument, then the decision supporting Plaquemines Parish's arguments. I butchered that. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, no, I'm trying to remember which state court's interests, which decision, the related case that was mentioned. They've sued a lot of different oil and gas companies. This is really, I mean, there's sort of a cottage industry of these trial lawyers going and finding counties and potential litigants in these cases to sue the oil and gas industries because it's a, you know, it's a little mini industry for them. So there's a bunch of cases that have been brought. And there's at least one that went to trial in the federal court, but it got kicked out because the grandfather clause was found to be dispositive on that one. Obviously the state court in this case went the other direction on that. So, I think the challenge is we all know this is why, form shopping is an issue. We all know that states, different states, different courts are known for having different tendencies or different likelihoods from one side to win or the other. And then when you have a situation where there's a jury being drawn from this specific county, which is the county that will receive all the money, I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars in winning the lawsuit, it makes it very hard to understand that you're going to have a completely balanced trial. And then when the judges in the case are also part of that same community. In a federal court, obviously, you're going to still be held in a Louisiana federal court. You're still drawing a jury pool from other residents of Louisiana, but it's not quite as focused on people who themselves could be experiencing something of a windfall from, or, you know, windfall or at least an influx of money. If you believe that they're due it, it's not really a windfall, but they stand to gain a significant amount from a win against Chevron in that particular case.
And then one last question. Just asking if Chevron should have known at the time when these federal contracts were made during World War II about, you know, the federal statutes and whether or not it applied.
Well, I mean, first of all, the fact that Chevron couldn't have known any of this during World War II is really a powerful, at least understandable reason that we think this feels very unjust, I think, to the average person, because it's not only they certainly couldn't have been aware of the federal removal statute because that was amended. The relevant language was added to it in 2011. So nowhere near the time that it was happening. So they were clearly not acting in the shadow of this federal removal statute. What they probably were acting in the shadow of is the desire to help the war effort and to cooperate with the federal government. This is what all, you know, both domestic and international activities of the country were doing during that period. So they could not have known of the federal removal statute. And of course, they absolutely could not have known of the 1978 law that would be passed three decades and some later from the activity they were doing. So of course, there's no way they were going to apply for for the relevant permits when they were not ever, you know, part of the legal system for another 40 years, but almost beyond when the drilling occurred. So, you know, at the end of the day, that fundamental sense of injustice isn't really what the court is going to be deciding based on. It really has to do with their interpretation of the federal removal statute. But it illustrates the difficulties with letting a court that, you know, may have its own interests make those decisions, because I think it can lead to outcomes that can seem unjust or not even-handed.
Yeah. Even Chevron can't time travel, you know, see the effect of what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But anyway, well, I think we are about set to wrap up, at least with what, you know, Carrie and her expertise can break down from oral arguments, or what we can guess at. But we just have to wait till June, or whenever they decide to drop the decision. But Carrie, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your insights and expertise. If our audience is interested in learning more about all of our programming here at the Federalist Society, please visit our website at fedsoc.org. That is FEDSOC.org. Or feel free to send us your feedback. We always love to hear it at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. Thank you so much. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.